The ornate gilded case clock standing against the wall chimed, small figures of gold and silver and enamel moving on three levels. On the highest, above the clock face, a king and queen knelt to an Ammerlin seat. Unlike the wide stole resting on Elida's shoulders, that Ammerlin's stole still had the seven stripes. She had not yet gotten around to bringing in an enameler. There was so much to be done that was so much more important. Adjusting her stole on the bright red silk of her dress, she leaned back so the flame of Tarvalin, picked out in moonstones on the tall gilded chairback, would stand directly above her head. She intended to make the man take in every symbol of who she was and what she represented. Had the flame-topped staff been at hand, she would have held it under his crooked nose. "A dead man can reclaim nothing, my son. From here, with my help, it may be that you can reclaim your crown and your nation." Matin Stepanaeus' mouth opened a crack and he inhaled deeply, like a man scenting a home he had never thought to see again.
"And how would you arrange that, mother? I understand the city do be held by these Ashaman," he fumbled the cursed name slightly, "and Aiel, who followed the dragon reborn."
Someone had been talking to him, telling him too much. His news of events was to be strictly rationed. It seemed his serving man would have to be replaced. But hope had washed the anger from his voice, and that was to the good. "Regaining your crown will require planning and time," she told him, since at the moment she had no idea of how it could be accomplished. She certainly intended to find a way, however. Kidnapping the King of Ilion had been meant to demonstrate her power, but restoring him to a stolen throne would demonstrate it even further. She would rebuild the full glory of the White Tower at its highest, the days when thrones trembled if the Ammerlin seat frowned. "I am sure you are still weary from your journey," she said, standing, just as if he had undertaken it of his own free will. She hoped he was intelligent enough to make that pretense, too. It would serve them both far better than the truth in the days to come. "We will dine together at midday and discuss what might be done. Cariandra, escort His Majesty to his rooms and see to fetching a tailor. He will need new clothes made. A gift from me." The plump Gildan in red, who had been standing still as a mouse beside the door to the anteroom, glided forward to touch his arm. He hesitated, reluctant to go, but Elida continued as though he were already leaving. "Tell Tarna to come in to me, Cariandra. I have a great deal of work today," she added for his benefit. At last Matin Stepanaeus let himself be turned, and she sat down again before he reached the door. Three lacquered boxes were arranged just so on the tabletop, one her correspondence box, where she kept recently received letters and reports from the Ajahs. The red shared whatever their eyes and ears learned, she thought they did, but the other Ajahs still provided only dribbles, though they had produced a number of unwelcome pieces of information in the last week or so. Unwelcome in part because they indicated contact with the rebels that must go beyond those farcical negotiations. It was the fat gold-embossed leather folder in front of her that she opened, however. The tower itself generated enough reports to have buried the table had she tried to read them all herself, and Tarvalin produced 10 times as many. Clerks handled the vast majority, selecting only the most important for her to read. They still made a thick stack. "You wanted me, mother?" Tarna said coolly, shutting the door behind her. There was no disrespect in it. The yellow-haired woman was cold by nature, her blue eyes icy. Elida did not mind that. What irritated her was that the bright red keeper's stole around Tarna's neck was little more than a wide ribbon. Her pale gray dress was slashed with enough red to display her pride in her Aja, so why was her stole so narrow? But Elida had a great deal of trust in the woman, and of late that was a rare commodity. "What news from the harbor, Tarna?" There was no need to say which. North Harbor alone had any hope of remaining functional without massive repairs. "Only river ships of the shallowest draft can enter," Tarna said, crossing the carpet to stand in front of the writing table. She might have been discussing the possibility of rain. Nothing fazed her. But the rest are taking turns tying up to the part of the chain that's Quendiar so they can offload into barges. The ship captains complain, and it takes considerably longer, yet for the time being we can make do.
Elida's mouth compressed, and she drummed her fingers on the tabletop. For the time being. She could not begin to repair the harbors until the rebels finally collapsed. So far they had not launched an assault, thank the light. That might begin with soldiers only, yet sisters certainly would be drawn into it, something they must want to evade as much as she did. But raising the harbor towers as repairs would require, laying the harbors open and defenseless might lead them to desperate acts. Light. Fighting must be avoided, if at all possible. She intended to fold their army into the tower guard once they realized they were finished and returned to the tower. Part of her already thought as if Gareth Bryn were commanding the tower guard for her. An infinitely better man for High Captain than Jamar Chubane. The world would know the White Tower's influence then. She did not want her soldiers killing one another, any more than she wanted the tower weakened by her Aes Sedai killing one another. The rebels were hers as much as those inside the tower, and she meant to make them acknowledge it. Picking up the top sheet from the stack of reports, she scanned it rapidly. "Apparently, despite my express order, the streets are still not being cleaned. Why?" An uneasy light appeared in Tarna's eyes, the first time Elida had ever seen her look troubled. "People are frightened, Mother. They don't leave their homes except at need, and with great reluctance even then. They say they have seen the dead walking in the streets." "This has been confirmed?" Elida asked quietly. Her blood suddenly seemed chill. "Have any sisters seen them?"
"None in the red, that I know of."
The others would speak with her as keeper, yet not freely, not to share confidences. How, under the light, was that to be mended?
"But people in the city are adamant. They have seen what they've seen."
Slowly, Elida set the page down to one side. She wanted to shiver. So, she had read everything she could find concerning the last battle, even studies and foretellings so old they had never been translated out of the old tongue and had lain covered in dust in the darkest corners of the library. The Althor boy had been a harbinger, but now it seemed that Tarmon Gaiden would come sooner than anyone had thought. Several of those ancient foretellings from the earliest days of the tower said the dead appearing was the first sign, a thinning of reality as the Dark One gathered himself. There would be worse before long.
"Have the tower guards drag able-bodied men out of their houses if need be," she said calmly. "I want those streets clean, and I want to hear that a start was made today. Today."
The other woman's pale eyebrows lifted in surprise. She had lost her usual frigid self-control. But all she said, of course, was,
"As you command, Mother."
Elida projected serenity, but it was a charade. What would come, would come, and she still had secured no hold on the Althor boy. To think she had once had him right under her hand! If only she had known then. Curse Alviarin and that triply cursed proclamation calling anathema on anyone who approached him save through the tower. She would have recalled it, except that would seem weakness, and in any case the damage had been done beyond simple mending. Still, soon she would have Elaine back in hand, and the royal house of Andor was the key to winning Tarmon Gaiden. That she had foretold long ago, and news of rebellion against the Seanchan sweeping across Tarabon had been very pleasant reading. Not everything was a tangle of briars stabbing her from every side. Scanning the second report, she grimaced. No one liked sewers, yet they were one-third of the life's blood of a city, the other two being trade and clean water. Without the sewers, Tarvalin would become prey to a dozen diseases, overwhelming anything the sisters could do, not to mention even more malodorous than the rotting garbage must have made the streets already. Though trade was cut to a trickle for the moment, the water still came in at the upriver end of the island and was distributed to water towers throughout the city, then to fountains, ornamental and plain, that anyone was free to use. But now it seemed the sewer outlets on the downriver end of the island were nearly clogged. Dipping her pen in the ink jar, she scrawled, "I want these cleared by tomorrow," across the top of the page, and signed her name below. If the clerks had any sense, the work was already underway. But she never accused clerks of having much sense. The next report made her own eyebrows rise. Rats inside the tower? That was beyond serious. This should have been on top. Have someone check the wards, Tarna. Those wardings had held since the tower was built, but perhaps they could have weakened after 3,000 years. How many of those rats were the Dark One's spies? A rap came at the door, followed an instant later by a plump accepted named Annamara, who spread her striped skirts in a deep curtsy. "If it pleases you, Mother, Phalana Sedai and Nagain Sedai have brought a woman to you they found wandering in the tower. They say she wants to present a petition to the Ammerlin seat."
"Tell her to wait and offer her tea, Annamara," Tarna said briskly. "The mother is busy."
"No, no," Elida broke in.
"Send them in, child, send them in."
It had been too long since anyone had come to present her with a petition. She was of a mind to grant whatever it was, if it was not too ridiculous. Perhaps that would restart the flow. It was far too long since any sisters had come to her without being summoned, too. Perhaps the two Browns would end that drought as well. But only one woman entered the room, carefully closing the door behind her. By her silk riding dress and good cloak, she appeared to be a noblewoman or a prosperous merchant, a supposition supported by her confident manner. Elida was sure she had never met the woman before, yet there seemed something vaguely familiar about that face, framed by hair even fairer than Tarna's. Elida stood and started around the table, hands outstretched and an unaccustomed smile on her face. She tried to make it seem welcoming. "I understand that you have a petition for me, my daughter. Tarna, pour her some tea." The silver pot sitting on a silver tray atop the side table must still be at least warm. "The petition, it was something I let them believe in order to reach you unbruised, mother," the woman replied in Tarabonner accents, curtsying, and halfway through that, her face was suddenly that of Baen and Marinya. Embracing Sidar, Tarna wove a shield on the woman, but Elida contented herself with planting her fists on her hips. "To say that I'm surprised you dare show me your face would be an understatement, Baenin." "I managed to become part of what you might call the ruling council in Salidar," the Grey said calmly. "I made sure they sat there and did nothing, and I put the rumors about that many among them were in truth your secret adherents. The sisters, they were looking at one another with so much suspicion, I think me most might have returned to the tower soon at that point. But then other sitters beside the Blues appeared. The next I knew, they had chosen their own hall of the tower, and the ruling council, it was done. Still, I continued to do what I could. I know that you commanded me to remain with them until they were all ready to return, but that must happen within days now. If I may say, Mother, it was the most excellent decision not to try Egwene. For one thing, she has the genius for discovering new weaves, even better than Elaine Trakand or Nynaeve Almira. For another, before they raised her, Lilaine and Ramonda struggled with one another to be named Ammerlin. With Egwene alive, they will struggle again, but neither can succeed. Yes? Me, I think very soon now, sisters will begin following behind me. In a week or two, Lilaine and Ramonda will find themselves alone with the remainder of their so-called hall. How did you know the Elvire girl wasn't to be tried? Elida demanded. How did you know she's even alive? Unshield her, Tarna. Tarna complied, and Baenin gave her a nod as if in gratitude. A small gratitude. Those large blue-gray eyes might make Baenin appear constantly startled, but she was a very composed woman. Combine composure with a wholehearted dedication to the law, and also ambition, which she possessed in as great a measure, and Elida had known immediately that Baenin was the one to send off after the sisters fleeing the tower. And the woman had failed utterly. Oh, she had apparently sowed a little dissension, but really she had achieved nothing of what Elida had expected from her. Nothing. She would find her rewards commensurate with her failure. Egwene, she can enter Telaranriod simply by going to sleep, Mother. I myself have been there and seen her. but I must use a Turan Greal. I could not acquire any of those the rebels have to bring with me. In any event, she spoke to Swan Sanche in her dreams, it is claimed, though I think more likely in the world of dreams. Apparently she said that she is a prisoner, but she would not tell where, and she forbade any rescue attempt. May I pour myself that tea? Elida was so stunned she could not speak. She motioned Baenin to the side table, and the Grey curtsied again before going over to feel the silver pitcher cautiously with the back of her hand. The girl could enter Telairan Riod? And there were Turan Greal that allowed the same thing? The world of dreams was almost a legend. And according to those troubling scraps the Ajahs had deigned to share with her, the girl had rediscovered the weave for traveling, and made any number of other discoveries as well. They had been the determining factor in her decision to preserve the girl for the tower, but this on top of it?
If Egwene can do this, Mother, perhaps she really is a dreamer, Tarna said. The warning she gave Sylviana is useless, Tarna. The Shan Shan are still deep in Altara and barely touching Ilion.
At least the Ajahs were still willing to pass on everything they learned of the Shan Shan. Or rather, she hoped they passed on everything. The thought roughened her voice.
Unless they learn to travel, can you think of any precaution I need to take beyond what is already in place?
She could not, of course. The girl had forbidden a rescue. That was good on the face of it, but it indicated she still thought of herself as Amarlin. Well, Sylviana would remove that nonsense from her head soon enough if the sisters teaching her classes failed. Can she be fed enough of that potion to keep her out of Telairan Riod? Tarna grimaced slightly. No one liked that vile brew, even the Browns who had brought themselves to test it, and shook her head.
We can make her sleep through the night, but she would be useless for anything the next day, and who can say whether it would affect this ability of hers? May I pour for you, Mother?
Baenin said, balancing a thin white teacup on her fingertips.
Tarna?
The most important news I have...
I don't care for any tea, Elida said harshly.
Did you bring back anything to save your skin from your miserable failure? Do you know the weave for traveling or the skimming or...
There were so many. Perhaps they were all talents and skills that had been lost, but apparently most had not been named yet. The Grey peered at her across the teacup, her face very still.
Yes, she said at last. I cannot make Quendiar, but I can make the new healing weaves work as well as most sisters, and I know them all.
An edge of excitement crept into her voice.
The most marvelous is traveling.
Without asking permission, she embraced the source and wove spirit. A vertical line of silver appeared against one wall and widened into a view of snow-covered oaks. A cold breeze blew into the room, making the flames dance in the fireplace.
That is called a gateway. It can only be used to reach a place you know well, but you learn a place by making a gateway there, and to go somewhere you do not know well, you use skimming.
She altered the weave, and the opening dwindled into that silvery line once more, then widened again. The oaks were replaced by blackness, and a grey-painted barge railed and gated that floated on nothing against the opening.
"Release the weave," Elida said.
She had the feeling that if she walked over to that barge, the darkness would extend as far as she could see in any direction, that she could fall in it forever. It made her queasy. The opening, the gateway, vanished. The memory remained, however. Resuming her seat behind the table, she opened the largest of the lacquered boxes, decorated with red roses and golden scrollwork. From the top tray she picked up a small ivory carving, a fork-tailed swallow dark yellow with years, and stroked her thumb along the curved wings.
"You will not teach these things to anyone without receiving my permission."
"But why ever not, Mother?"
"Some of the Ajahs oppose the Mother almost as strongly as those sisters beyond the river," Tarna said.
Elida shot a dark look at her keeper, but that cool visage absorbed it without changing a hair.
"I will decide who is reliable enough to be taught, Baenin. I want your promise. No, I want your oath. On my way here, I saw sisters of different Ajahs glaring at one another.
glaring. What has happened in the tower, mother?
Your oath, Bannon.
The woman stood peering into her teacup long enough that Elida was beginning to think she would refuse. But ambition won out. She had tied herself to Elida's skirts in the hope of preferment, and she would not abandon that now. Under the light and by my hope of salvation and rebirth, I swear that I will teach the weaves I learned among the rebels to no one without the permission of the Ammerlin seat. She paused, taking a sip from the cup. Some sisters in the tower, they are perhaps less reliable than you think. I tried to stop it, but that ruling council sent 10 sisters to return to the tower and spread the tale of the Red Aja and Loghain. Elida recognized few of the names she reeled off, until the last. That one made her sit bolt upright.
"Shall I have them arrested, mother?"
Tarna asked, still as chill as ice.
"No. Have them watched.
Watch whoever they associate with." So there was a conduit between the Ajas inside the tower and the rebels. How deeply had the rot spread? However deep, she would clean it out.
"That may be difficult as matters stand, mother."
Elida slapped the table with her free hand, a sharp crack. "I didn't ask whether it would be difficult. I said, do it! And inform Maid Donnie that I invite her to dinner this evening." The woman had been persistent in trying to resume a friendship that had ended many years before. Now she knew why.
"Go and do that now."
A shadow crossed Tarna's face as she curtsied.
"Don't worry," Elida said. "Bannon can feel free to teach you every weave she knows."
She did trust Tarna after all, and it certainly made her expression brighter, if no warmer. As the door closed behind her keeper, Elida pushed the leather folder to one side and leaned her elbows on the table, focusing on Bannon.
"Now, show me everything."
Chapter 3. At the Gardens. Arengar arrived in answer to Moradin's summons, spoken into her furious dreams, to find him not yet there. That was hardly surprising. He liked to make an entrance. 11 tall armchairs, carved and gilded, sat in a circle in the middle of the striped wooden floor, but they were empty. Semirag, all in black as usual, looked around to see who had entered, then returned to her huddled conversation with Dimandred and Messana in one corner of the room. Dimandred's hook-nosed face carried an expression of anger that only made him more striking. Not enough to attract her, of course. He was far too dangerous for that. That well-fitted coat of bronze silk with folds of snowy lace at neck and wrists suited him, however. Messana also wore the style of this age, a darker, pattern-embroidered bronze. She appeared wan and subdued for some reason, almost as if she had taken ill. Well, that was possible. This age had a number of nasty diseases, and it seemed unlikely even she would trust Semirag for healing. Grendal, the only other human present, stood in the corner opposite, cradling a delicate crystal goblet filled with dark wine, but watching the trio rather than drinking. Only idiots ignored being studied by Grendal, yet the three went on with their fierce murmurs. The chairs jarred with the rest of their surroundings. The room appeared to have view walls, though the stone arch of a doorway destroyed the illusion. The chairs could have been anything here in Tel Ironriad. So why not something to suit the room? And why 11, when that was surely two more than needed? Asmodian and Samael must be as dead as Belal and Ravin. Why not the usual dilating door of a view room? The display made the floor seem to be surrounded by the Anseline Gardens, with Cormalind Massoon's immense sculptures of stylized humans and animals towering over low buildings themselves like delicate sculptures in spin glass. At the gardens, only the finest wines had been served, the finest dishes, and it almost always had been possible to impress a beautiful woman with large winnings at the ginger wheels, though cheating enough to win consistently had been difficult. Difficult, but necessary for a scholar who lacked wealth. All gone, in ruins by the third year of the war. A golden-haired, ever-smiling Zomara in a flowing white blouse and tight breeches bowed fluidly and offered Arangar a crystal goblet of wine on a silver tray. Graceful and beautifully androgynous, apparently human despite those dead-black eyes, the creatures had been one of Aganor's less inspired creations. Still, even in their own age, when Moradin had been called Ishamael, there was no longer any doubt in her mind of who he was. He had trusted the creatures above any human servant, despite their uselessness for every other task. Somewhere he must have found a stasis box stuffed with the things. He had dozens, although he seldom brought them out, yet 10 more stood waiting, graceful while standing still. He must consider this meeting more important than most. Taking the goblet, she waved the Zomara away, though it was already turning before she gestured. She hated the creature's ability to know what was in her head. At least it could not communicate what it learned to anyone. Memories of anything but commands faded in minutes. Even Aganor possessed sense enough to see the need for that. Would he appear today? Osengar had missed every meeting since the failure at Shadar Logoth. The true question was he among the dead, or was he moving in secret, perhaps at the Great Lord's direction? Either way, his absences presented delicious opportunities, but the latter presented as many dangers. Dangers had been much on her mind lately. Casually, she strolled over to Grendel.
"Who do you think arrived first, Grendel? The Shadow Take Me, whoever it was, chose a depressing setting."
Lanfear had preferred meetings that floated in endless night, yet this was worse in its own way, like meeting in a cemetery. Grendel smiled thinly. At least she attempted a thin smile, but no amount of effort would make those lips thin. Lush was the word for all of Grendel. Lush and ripe and beautiful, and barely concealed by the gray mist of her Streeth gown. Though perhaps she should not have worn quite so many rings, all but one adorned with gems. The coronet encrusted with rubies clashed with her sun-gold hair, too. The emerald necklace Delana had provided went much better with her own green satin silks. Of course, while the emeralds were real, her silks were a product of the world of dreams. She would have attracted too much notice in the waking world with a dress cut so low, if it would even stay up, there. And there was the slit that bared her left leg to the hip. Her legs were better than Grendel's. She had considered 2 slits. Her abilities here were not as large as some. She could not find Egwene's dreams without the girl right beside her. But she could manage the clothes she wanted. She enjoyed having her body admired, and the more she flaunted it, the more the others took her for inconsequential.
"I arrived first," Grendel said, frowning slightly into her wine. "I have fond memories of the gardens."
Arangar managed a laugh.
"So do I. So do I."
The woman was a fool like the rest, living in the past among the tatters of what was lost.
"We'll never see the gardens again, but we'll see their like."
She herself was the only one of them suited to rule in this age. She was the only one who understood primitive cultures. They had been her specialty before the war. Still, Grendel had useful skills and a wider range of contacts among the Friends of the Dark than she herself had, though the other woman would certainly disapprove of how Arangar meant to use them, should she learn.
"Has it occurred to you that all of the others have alliances, while you and I stand alone?"
And Osengar, if he was alive, but there was no need to bring him into this. Grendel's gown turned a darker gray, regrettably obscuring the view. It was real Streeth. Arangar had found a pair of stasis boxes herself, but filled with the most appalling rubbish for the most part.
"Has it occurred to you that this room must have ears? The Zomaran were here when I arrived." "Grendel," she purred the name. "If Moradin is listening, he'll assume I'm trying to get into your bed. He knows I never made alliances with anyone."
In truth, she had made several, but her allies always seemed to suffer fatal misfortunes once their usefulness ended, and they took all knowledge of the affiliations to their graves. Those who found graves. The Streeth went black as midnight in Larchine,
and spots of color appeared on Grendel's creamy cheeks. Her eyes became blue eyes, but her words were at odds with her face, and her gown faded to near transparency as she spoke, slowly, sounding thoughtful.
"An intriguing notion, one I have never before considered. I might do so now, perhaps. You will have to convince me, though."
"Good." The other woman was as quick-witted as ever. It was a reminder that she must be careful. She meant to use Grendel and dispose of her, not be caught in one of her traps.
"I am very good at convincing beautiful women."
She stretched out a hand to caress Grendel's cheek. Now was not too soon to begin convincing the others. Besides, something more than an alliance might come of it. She had always fancied Grendel. She no longer really remembered having been a man. In her memories, she wore the body she did now, which did make for a few oddities, yet that body's influence had not changed everything. Her appetites had not altered, only broadened. She would very much like to have that Streith gown, and anything else useful that Grendel might possess, of course, but she dreamed of wearing that dress sometimes. The only reason she was not wearing one now was that she would not have the other woman thinking she had imitated her. The Streith remained barely opaque, but Grendel stepped away from the caress, looking past Arengar, who turned to find Messana approaching, flanked by Demandred and Semirag. He still appeared angry, and Semirag coolly amused. Messana was still pale, but no longer subdued. No, not subdued at all. She was a hissing career, spitting venom.
"Why did you let her go, Arengar? You were supposed to be controlling her. Were you so busy playing your little dream games with her that you forgot to learn what she was thinking? The rebellion will fall apart without her for a figurehead. All my careful planning ruined because you couldn't keep a grasp on one ignorant girl."
Arengar held on to her temper firmly. She could hold it when she was willing to make the effort. Instead of snarling, she smiled. Could Messana actually have based herself inside the White Tower? How wonderful it would be if she could find a way to split that threesome apart.
"I listened in on a sitting of the Rebels' Hall last night, in the world of dreams, so they could meet inside the White Tower with Egwene leading it."
"She's not the figurehead you believe. I've tried telling you before, but you never listened."
That came out too hard. With an effort, and it required effort, she moderated her tone.
"Egwene told them all about the situation inside the tower, the Ajahs at one another's throats. She convinced them it's the tower that is about to fall apart and that she might be able to help it along from where she is. Were I you, I'd worry whether the tower can hold together long enough to keep this conflict going."
"They're determined to hold on," Messana murmured, half under her breath.
She nodded.
"Good. Good. Then everything is proceeding according to plan. I had been thinking I would need to stage some sort of rescue, but perhaps I can wait until Elida has broken her. Her return should create even more confusion then. You need to sow more dissension, Arengar. Before I'm done, I want those so-called Aes Sedai hating each other in their blood."
A Zumara appeared, bowing gracefully as it offered a tray with three goblets. Messana and her companions took the wine without a glance at the creature, and it bowed again before flowing away.
"Dissension was always something she was good at," Semirag said.
Demandred laughed. Arengar forced her anger down. Sipping her own wine, it was quite good, with a heady aroma, if nowhere near the vintages served at the gardens. She laid her free hand on Grendel's shoulder and toyed with one of those sun-colored curls. The other woman never flinched, and the Streith remained a bare mist. Either she was enjoying this, or she had better control of herself than seemed possible. Semirag's smile grew more amused. She, too, took her pleasures where she found them, though Semirag's pleasures had never attracted Arengar.
"If you're going to fondle one another," Demandred growled, "do it in private."
"Jealous," Arengar murmured, and laughed lightly at his scowl. "Where is the girl kept, Messana? She didn't say."
Messana's big blue eyes narrowed.
They were her best feature, yet only ordinary when she frowned.
"Why do you want to know? So you can rescue her yourself? I won't tell you."
Rendal hissed, and Arengar realized that her hand had become a fist in that golden hair, bending Grendel's head back. The other woman's face remained tranquil, but her gown was a red mist and rapidly growing darker, more opaque. Arengar loosened her grip, holding on lightly. "One of the first steps was making your quarry accustomed to your touch." She did nothing to keep the anger from her voice this time, however. Her bared teeth were an undisguised snarl.
"I want the girl, Mesaana. Without her, I have much weaker tools to work with."
Mesaana sipped wine calmly before responding.
"Calmly?" "By your own account, you don't need her at all. It has been my plan from the start, Arengar. I will adapt it according to need, but it is mine. And I will decide when and where the girl is set free."
"No, Mesaana. I will decide when and where, or whether she is freed,"
Moradin announced, striding through the stone arch. So he had set ears in place. He was in unrelieved black this time, a black somehow darker than what Semirag wore. As usual, Mogadin and Sindane followed him, both attired in identical red and black that suited neither. What hold did he have on them? Mogadin, at least, had never willingly followed anyone. As for that beautiful, bosomy little pale-haired doll Sindane, Arengar had approached her just to see what might be learned, and the girl had coldly threatened to rip her heart out if Arengar touched her again. Hardly the words of someone who submitted easily.
"Samael appears to have resurfaced," Moradin announced, crossing the floor to take a seat. He was a big man, and he made the ornate, high-backed chair seem a throne. Mogadin and Sindane sat down to either side of him, but interestingly, not until he had. Zomarin, in snowy white, were there instantly with wine, yet Moradin received his first. Whatever was at work there, the Zomarin sensed it.
"That hardly seems possible," Grendel said as they all moved to take chairs. Her gown was dark gray now, concealing everything. "He must be dead."
No one moved quickly, though. Moradin was nameless, yet no one except Mogadin and Sindane was willing to display any hint of subservience. Arengar certainly was not. She took a seat across from Moradin, where she could watch him without seeming to, and Mogadin and Sindane. Mogadin was so still she would have faded into the chair except for her bright dress. Sindane was a queen, her face chiseled from ice. Trying to pull down the Nablus was dangerous, yet those two might hold the key. If she could figure out how to turn it. Grendel sat down beside her, and the chair was suddenly closer. Arengar could have laid her hand on the other woman's wrist, but refrained from anything more than a slow smile. It was best to keep her mind centered right then.
"He could never have borne staying hidden this long," Demendred put in, lounging into his chair between Semirag and Mesaana, legs crossed as though perfectly at ease.
That seemed doubtful. He was another who was unreconciled, she was sure.
Samael needed to have every eye directed at him. Nevertheless, Samael, or someone disguised as him, gave orders to Myrdral, and they obeyed. So it was one of the Chosen.
Moradin scanned around the chairs as though he could detect who it had been. Black Sa trickled across his blue eyes in a continuous stream. She had no regrets that the true power was limited to his use alone now. The price was much too high. Ishamael had certainly been at least half insane, and he still was as Moradin. How long before she could remove him?
"Are you going to tell us what these orders were?"
Semirag's tone was cool, and she sipped her wine calmly, watching Moradin over the goblet's rim. She sat very erect, but she always did. She too appeared completely at ease, yet that was unlikely. Moradin's jaw tightened.
"I don't know," he said at last, reluctantly. He never liked saying that. but they sent 100 Murdrol and thousands of Trollocs into the ways. That sounds like Samael, Demandred said thoughtfully, twisting his goblet and studying the swirling wine. Perhaps I was mistaken. A remarkable admission coming from him, or an attempt to hide being the one who had worn Samael as a disguise. She would very much like to know who had begun playing her own game, or whether Samael really was alive. Morden grunted sourly. Pass orders to your friends of the Dark. Any report of Trollocs or Murdrol outside the Blight is to be handed to me as soon as you receive it. The time of return is coming soon. No one is allowed to go adventuring on their own any longer.
He studied them again, each in turn save for Mogadane and Sindane. With a smile even more languorous than Grendel's, Arengar met his gaze. Misana shrank back from it.
As you learned to your sorrow, he told Misana, and impossible as it seemed, her face went paler still.
She took a long drink from her goblet, her teeth clicking on the crystal. Semirag and Demandred avoided looking at her. Arengar exchanged looks with Grendel. Something had been done to punish Masana's failure to appear at Shadarlogoth, but what?
Once, dereliction on that scale would have meant death. They were too few for that now. Sindane and Mogadane appeared as curious as she was, so they did not know either.
We can see the signs as clearly as you, Moradin, Demandred said irritably. The time is near. We need to find the rest of the seals on the Great Lord's prison. I've had my followers searching everywhere, but they've found nothing.
Ah, yes, the seals. Indeed, they must be found.
Moradin's smile was almost complacent.
Only three remain, all in Althor's possession, though I doubt he has them with him. They're too susceptible to breaking now. He will have hidden them. Direct your people to places he has been. Search them yourselves.
The easiest way is to kidnap Luz Theron.
In strong contrast to her ice-maiden appearance, Sindane's voice was breathy and sultry, a voice made for lying on soft pillows wearing very little. There was considerable heat in those big blue eyes now, a searing heat.
I can make him tell where the seals are.
No,
Morden snapped, fixing her with a steady stare.
You would accidentally kill him. The time and manner of Althor's death will be at my choosing, no one else.
Strangely, he put his free hand to the breast of his coat, and Sindane flinched. Mogadine shivered.
No one else, he repeated in a hard voice.
No one else,
Sindane said. When he lowered his hand, she exhaled softly, then took a swallow of wine. Sweat glistened on her forehead. Arengar found the exchange illuminating. It seemed that once she had disposed of Moradin, she would have Mogadine and the girl on leashes. Very good indeed. Moradin straightened himself in his chair, directing that stare at the rest of them.
That goes for all of you. Althor is mine. You will not harm him in any way.
Sindane bent her head over her goblet, sipping, but the hatred in her eyes was plain. Grendel had said she was not Lanfear, that she was weaker in the One Power, but she surely was fixated on Althor, and she called him by the same name Lanfear had always used.
If you want to kill someone, he went on, kill these two.
Suddenly the semblances of two young men in rough country clothes stood in the center of the circle, turning so that everyone could get a good look at their faces. One was tall and wide, with yellow eyes of all things, while the other was not quite slender, and wore a cheeky grin. Creations of Telairanriad, they moved stiffly, and their expressions never altered.
Perrin Ebarra and Matt Cawthon are Taviren, easily found. Find them and kill them.
Grendel laughed a mirthless laugh.
Finding Taviren was never as simple as you made out, and now it's harder than ever. The whole pattern is in flux, full of shifts and spikes. Perenebara and Matt Cawthon, Simarag murmured, inspecting the two shapes. So that is what they look like. Who knows, Moradin? If you had shared this with us before now, they might already have been dead.
Moradin's fist came down hard on the arm of his chair.
Find them! Make doubly sure that your followers know their faces. Find Ebara and Cawthon and kill them. The time is coming and they must be dead.
Arengar took a sip of her wine. She had no objections to killing these two if she happened to come across them. But Moradin was going to be terribly disappointed over Randall Thor.
Chapter 4. A Deal.
Perrin sat Stepper's saddle a little back from the edge of the trees and watched the large meadow where red and blue wildflowers were beginning to poke through the winter brown grass that the now vanished snows had flattened into a mat. This stand was mainly leatherleaf that kept its broad dark foliage through the winter, but only a few small pale leaves decorated the branches of the sweet gums among them. The dun stallion stamped a hoof with an impatience Perrin shared, though he let none of it show. The sun stood almost overhead. He had been waiting there nearly an hour. A stiff, steady breeze blew out of the west down the meadow toward him. That was good. Every so often his gauntleted hand stroked a nearly straight branch hacked from an oak, thicker than his forearm and more than twice as long, that lay across the saddle in front of him. For half its length he had shaved two sides, flat and smooth. The meadow, ringed by huge oaks and leatherleaf, towering pine and shorter sweet gum, was less than 600 paces wide, though longer than that. The branch should be broad enough. He had planned for every possibility he could imagine. The branch fit more than one.
"My lady first, you should return to the camp," Galen said, not for the first time, rubbing irritably at his red eye patch.
His crimson-plumed helmet hung from the pommel of his saddle, leaving his shoulder-length gray hair uncovered. He had been heard to say, in Barilane's hearing, that most of those gray hairs were presents from her. His black warhorse tried to take a nip at Stepper, and he reined the heavy-chested gelding sharply without taking his attention from Barilane. He had counseled against her coming in the first place.
"Grady can take you back and return while the rest of us wait a while longer to see whether the Seanchan are going to show up."
"I will remain, Captain. I will remain."
Barilane's tone was firm and calm, yet beneath her usual smell of patience lay an edge of concern. She was not so certain as she made herself sound. She had taken to wearing a light perfume that smelled of flowers. Perrin sometimes found himself trying to puzzle out which flowers, but he was too focused for idle thoughts today. Vexation spiked in Anura's scent, though her ageless, Aes Sedai face, framed by dozens of thin braids, remained as smooth as ever. But then, the beak-nosed Grey Sister had smelled vexed ever since the rift between her and Barilane. It was her own fault, visiting Massima behind Barilane's back. She also had counseled Barilane to stay behind. Anura edged her brown mare closer to the first of Mayen, and Barilane moved her white mare just that far away without so much as a glance in her advisor's direction. Vexation spiked again. Barilane's red silk dress, heavily embroidered in golden scrollwork, displayed more bosom than she had in some time, though a wide necklace of fire drops and opals provided a degree of modesty. A wide matching belt, supporting a jeweled dagger, cinched her waist. The narrow crown of Mayenne, resting on her black hair, holding a golden hawk in flight above her brows, appeared ordinary beside the belt and necklace. She was a beautiful woman, the more so, it seemed to him, since she had stopped chasing him, though still not a patch on Fael, of course. Anura wore an unadorned gray riding dress, but most of them were in their best. For Perrin, that was a dark green silk coat with silver embroidery covering the sleeves and shoulders. He was not much for fancy clothes. Fael had chivied him into buying what little he had. Well, she had chivied him gently, but today he needed to impress. If the wide plain leather belt fastened over the coat spoiled the impression a little, so be it.
"She must come," Arganda muttered.
A short, stocky man, Alejandra's first captain had not removed his silvered helmet with its three short white plumes, and he sat his saddle, easing his sword in its scabbard as though awaiting a charge. His breastplate was silver-plated, too. He would be visible for miles out in the sunlight.
She must.
The prophet says they won't, Aram put in, and not softly, heeling his leggy gray up beside Stepper. The brass wolf-head pommel of his sword stuck up over the shoulder of his green-striped coat. Once he had seemed too good-looking for a man, but now his face grew grimmer every day. There was a haggardness about him, his eyes sunken and his mouth tight. The prophet says either that, or it's a trap. He says we shouldn't trust the Shan Chan. Perrin held his silence, but he felt his own spike of irritation, as much with himself as with the one-time tinker. Balwer had informed him that Aram had begun spending time with Massima, yet it had seemed unnecessary to tell the man not to let Massima know everything Perrin was doing. There was no putting the egg back into the shell, but he would know better in the future. A workman should know his tools and not use them to breaking. The same went for people. As for Massima, no doubt he was afraid they would meet someone who knew he himself was dealing with the Shan Chan. They were a large party, though most would remain right there among the trees. 50 of Berylane's winged guards in rimmed red helmets and red breastplates, scarlet streamers floating from their slender steel-tipped lances, were mounted behind the golden hawk on blue of Mayenne, rippling on the breeze. Beside them, 50 Gildanin in burnished breastplates and dark green conical helmets sat their horses behind Gildan's three silver stars on red. The streamers on their lances were green. They made a brave show, yet all of them together were far less deadly than Jur Grady, with his weathered farmer's face, even if they made him appear drab in his plain black coat with a silver sword pin on the high collar. He knew it, whether or not they did, and he stood beside his bay gelding with the ease of a man resting before the day's labor. In contrast, Leof Torfinn and Tod Alkar, the only other Two Rivers men present, were still all but bouncing in their saddles with excitement despite the long wait. It might have taken some of their pleasure away had they known they had been chosen in large part because they came nearest fitting their borrowed coats of dark, finely woven green wool. Leof carried Perrin's own red wolf-head banner, Tod the red eagle of Manetherin, both rippling on staffs a little longer than the lances. They had almost come to blows over who was to carry which. Perrin hoped it was not because neither wanted to carry the red-bordered wolf-head. Leof looked happy enough. Tod looked ecstatic. Of course, he did not know why Perrin had brought the thing along. In any trade, you needed to make the other fellow think he was getting something extra, as Matt's father often said. Colors swirled in Perrin's head, and for a brief instant he thought he saw Matt talking to a small dark woman. He shook off the image. Here and now, today, were all that mattered. Fael was all that mattered. They will come, Arganda snapped in answer to Aram, though he glared through the face bars of his helmet as if expecting a challenge.
What if they don't?
Galen demanded, his one eye scowling as fiercely as Arganda's pair. His red-lacquered breastplate was not much better than Arganda's silvered one. Small chance they could be talked into painting them something dull.
What if it is a trap? Arganda growled, almost a wolf's guttural growl.
The man was near the end of his tether. The breeze brought the scent of horses only moments before Perrin's ears caught the first blue-tits trills, too distant for anyone else to hear. They came from the trees flanking the meadow. Large parties of men, perhaps unfriendly, were entering the woods. More trills sounded closer.
They're here, he said, which earned him looks from Arganda and Galen.
He tried to avoid revealing the acuteness of his hearing, or his sense of smell, yet that pair had been on the point of coming to blows. The relayed trills grew nearer, and everyone could hear them. The two men's looks grew odd.
I can't risk the lady first if there's any chance of a trap, Galen said, buckling on his helmet.
They all knew what the signal meant.
The choice is mine, Captain, Berylane replied before Perrin could open his mouth.
And your safety is my responsibility, my lady first.
Berylaine drew breath, her face darkening, but Perrin got there first.
"I told you how we're going to spring that trap, if that's what it is. You know how suspicious the Shan Chan are. Likely they're worried about us ambushing them."
Galen harumphed loudly. The patience in Berylaine's smell flickered, then settled in again, rock steady.
"You should listen to him, Captain," she said with a smile for Perrin. "He knows what he is doing."
A party of riders appeared at the far end of the meadow and drew rein. Tallinbar was easy to pick out. In a dark coat and mounted on a good dappled gray, he was the only man not wearing armor vividly striped in red and yellow and blue. The other pair, unarmored, were women, one in blue, with red on her skirts and breast, the other in gray. The sun reflected off something connecting them. So, a Suldam and Damani. There had been no mention of that in all the negotiations carried out through Tallinvor, but Perrin had counted on it.
"It's time," he said, gathering Stepper's reins one-handed, "before she decides we're not coming."
Anura managed to get close enough to lay a hand on Berylaine's arm for a moment before the other woman could move her mare away.
"You should let me come with you, Berylaine. You may need my counsel, yes? This sort of negotiation is my specialty. I suspect the Shan Chan know an Aes Sedai face by now, don't you, Anura? I hardly think they'd negotiate with you. Besides," Berylaine added in a too sweet voice, "you must remain here to assist Master Grady."
Spots of color appeared briefly on the Aes Sedai's cheeks, and her wide mouth tightened. It had taken the Wise Ones to make her agree to take orders from Grady today, though Perrin was just as glad he did not know how they had done it. And she had been trying to wiggle out ever since leaving the camp.
"You stay too," Perrin said when Aram made to ride forward. "You've been hot-headed lately, and I won't risk you saying or doing the wrong thing out there. I won't risk Fael on it."
That was true. No need to say he would not risk the man carrying what was said out there back to Massima.
"You understand?"
Bubbles of disappointment filled Aram's scent, but he nodded, however reluctantly, and rested his hands on the pommel of his saddle. He might come close to worshipping Massima, but he would give his life 100 times over rather than risk Fael's. On purpose, anyway. What he did without thinking was another matter. Perrin rode out of the trees, flanked by Arganda on one side and Berylaine and Galen on the other. The banners followed behind, and 10 Mayenners and 10 Gildanen in a column of twos. As they walked their mounts forward, the Shan Chan started toward them, also in column, with Tallinvor riding beside the leaders, one on a roan, the other a bay. The horses' hooves made no sound in the thick mat of dead grass. The forest had gone silent, even to Perrin's ears. While the Mayenners and Gildanen spread out in a line, and most of the Shan Chan in their brightly painted armor did the same, Perrin and Berylaine advanced toward Tallinvor, and two of the armored Shan Chan, one with 3 thin blue plumes on that lacquered helmet that was so like an insect's head, the other with 2. The Suldam and Damani came too. They met in the middle of the meadow, surrounded by wildflowers and silence, with 6 paces between them. As Tallinvor positioned himself to one side between the two groups, the armored Shan Chan removed their helmets with hands in steel-backed gauntlets that were striped like the rest of their armor. The 2-plumed helmet revealed a yellow-haired man with 6 scars, seaming his square face. He was a hard-bitten man who smelled of amusement, strangely. But it was the other who interested Perrin. Mounted on the bay, a trained warhorse, if he had ever seen one, she was tall and broad-shouldered for a woman, though lean otherwise and not young. Gray marked the temples of her close-cut, tightly curled black hair. As dark as good topsoil, she displayed only 2 scars, one slanting across her left cheek. The other, on her forehead, had taken part of her right eyebrow. Some people thought scars a sign of toughness. It seemed to Perrin that fewer scars meant that you knew what you were doing. Confidence filled the scent of her in the breeze. Her gaze flickered across the fluttering banners. He thought she paused slightly on Manetheran's red eagle, and again on Mayenne's golden hawk, yet she quickly settled to studying him. Her expression never altered a whit, but when she noticed his yellow eyes, something unidentifiable entered her scent, something sharp and hard. When she saw the heavy blacksmith's hammer in its loop on his belt, the strange scent grew.
"I give you Pan Tebashir Ebarra, Lord of the Two Rivers, liege lord to Queen Aleandra of Gildan,"
Talanvor announced, raising a hand toward Perrin. He claimed the Seanchan were sticklers for formality, but Perrin had no idea whether this was a Seanchan ceremony or something from Andor. Talanvor could have made it up for all of him.
"I give you Berelain Sir Paendrag Peyron, first of Mayenne, blessed of the light, defender of the waves, high seat of House Peyron."
With a bow to the pair of them, he shifted his reins and raised the other hand toward the Seanchan.
"I give you Banner General Tylee Kirgan of the Ever-Victorious Army in service to the Empress of Seanchan. I give you Captain Bakayar Mishima of the Ever-Victorious Army in service to the Empress of Seanchan."
Another bow, and Talanvor turned his grey to ride back to a place beside the banners. His face was as grim as Aram's, but he smelled of hope.
"I'm glad he didn't name you the Wolf King, my lord," the Banner General drawled.
The way she slurred her words, Perrin had to listen hard to make out what she was saying.
"Otherwise, I'd think Tarman Gaiden was on us. You know the prophecies of the dragon? When the Wolf King carries the hammer, thus are the final days known. When the fox marries the raven, and the trumpets of battle are blown. I never understood that second line myself. And you, my lady, Sir Paendrag, that would mean from Paendrag?"
"My family is descended from Arta Paendrag Tanrial,"
Berelain replied, holding her head high. An eddy in the breeze brought a whiff of pride among the patients and perfume. They had agreed that Perrin was to do all of the talking. She was there to dazzle the Seanchan with a beautiful young ruler, or at least to lend weight to Perrin with it. But he supposed she had to answer a direct question. Tylee nodded as though that were exactly the answer she expected.
"That makes you a distant cousin of the Imperial family, my lady. No doubt the Empress, may she live forever, will honor you, so long as you make no claims to Hawkwing's empire yourself, anyway."
"The only claim I make is to Mayenne," Berelain said proudly, "and that I will defend to my last breath."
"I didn't come here to talk about the prophecies or Hawkwing or your Empress," Perrin said irritably.
For the second time in a matter of moments, those colors tried to coalesce in his head, only to be dispelled. He had no time. The Wolf King? Hopper would come as near to laughing as a wolf could over that. Any wolf would. Still, he felt a chill. He had not realized that he was mentioned in the prophecies. And his hammer was a harbinger of the last battle? But nothing mattered except Fael. Only her. And whatever it took to free her.
"The agreement for this meeting was no more than 30 in either party. But you have men in the woods on both sides of us. A lot of men." "So do you," Mishima said, with grin distorted by a white scar that met the corner of his mouth. "Or you wouldn't know about ours."
His drawl was worse than hers. Perrin kept his eyes on the Banner General.
"As long as they both remain, there's the chance of accidents. I don't want any accidents. I want my wife back from the Shido." "And how do you propose we avoid accidents?" Mishima said, idly flipping his reins.
He sounded as though the question was not urgent. It seemed Tylee was content to let him do the talking while she observed Perrin's reactions.
"Are we supposed to trust you if we send our men out first, or you to trust us if we ask you to withdraw first? On the heights, the paths are paved with daggers. There isn't much room for trust. I suppose we could both order our men to pull back at the same time, but one side might cheat."
Perrin shook his head.
"You're going to have to trust me, Banner General. I have no reason to want to attack you or capture you, and every reason not to. I can't be sure of the same about you.
You might think capturing the first of Mayen worth a little betrayal. Berylaine laughed softly. It was time for the branch. Not just to force the Seanchan out of the woods first, but to convince them that they needed what he could offer. He stood the branch upright on the saddle in front of him. I expect your men are probably good soldiers. My men aren't soldiers, though they've fought Trollocs and Shido and done well against both. Gripping the branch at its base, he held it high overhead, the shaved sides uppermost and facing either side. But they're used to hunting lions and leopards and ridge cats come down out of the mountains after our flocks, and wild boar and bear, animals that hunt back, in forests not much different from this. The branch tried to twist violently in his gauntleted fist as twin impacts, not a heartbeat apart, shivered down his arm. He lowered the branch to display two pile arrows, their chiseled-shaped heads driven clear of the tough wood on either side. 300 paces was a long range for that target, but he had chosen Jondin Baran and Jori Conger to make the shots. They were the best he had. If it comes down to it, your men won't even see who's killing them, and that armor won't do much good against a Two Rivers longbow. I hope it doesn't come to that. With all of his strength, he heaved the branch up into the air. My eyes, Mishima growled, a hand going to his sword even as he tried to rein the roan back and watch Perrin and the branch all at the same time. His helmet toppled from his saddle to the grass. The banner general made no move toward her sword, though she also tried watching Perrin and the branch. At first she did. Then her gaze followed only the branch as it continued to climb until it hung centered between them 100 feet in the air. Abruptly a ball of flame enveloped the branch, so fierce that Perrin felt the heat as from an open furnace. Berylaine put a hand up to shield her face. Tylee merely watched thoughtfully. The fire lasted just moments, yet that was enough to leave only ash drifting on the breeze when it vanished. Ash, and two plummeting specks that fell into the dry grass. Small flames shot up immediately and began growing, spreading. Even the warhorses snorted in fear. Berylaine's mare danced in an attempt to fight her reins and flee. Perrin muttered a curse. He should have thought of the arrowheads, and started to dismount to stomp out the fire, but before he could swing his leg over the saddle, the flames vanished, leaving only thin tendrils of smoke rising from a patch of blackened grass.
Good Nori, the Suldam murmured, patting the Damani. Nori is a wonderful Damani.
The gray-clad woman smiled shyly at the praise. Despite her words, the Suldam looked worried.
So, Tali said, you have a Marath...
She paused, pursing her lips.
You have an Aes Sedai with you. More than one? No matter. I can't say the Aes Sedai I've seen have impressed me very much.
Not Marath Damani, my general,
the Suldam said quietly. Tylee sat very still, studying Perrin intently.
Ashaman, she said at last, not a question. You begin to interest me, my lord.
Then maybe one last thing will convince you, Perrin said. Todd, roll that banner around the staff and bring it here. Hearing nothing behind him, he looked over his shoulder. Todd was staring at him with a stricken look. Todd! Giving himself a shake, Todd began winding the red eagle around its staff. He still looked unhappy when he rode forward and handed it to Perrin, though. He sat there with his hand still stretched out as though hoping the staff might be returned to him. Heeling stepper toward the Seanchan, Perrin held the banner in front of him in his fist parallel to the ground. The Two Rivers was the heart of Manetherin, Banner General. The last king of Manetherin died in a battle right where Emmons Field, the village I was born in, grew up. Manetherin is in our blood, but the Shido have my wife prisoner. To free her, I'll give up any claim to reviving Manetherin. Sign any sort of oath on it you want. That claim would be a field of brambles for you, Seanchan. You could be the one who cleared that field without a drop of bloodshed. Behind him, someone groaned miserably. He thought it was Todd.
Suddenly the breeze was a gale howling in the opposite direction, pelting them with grit, blowing so hard that he had to cling to his saddle to keep from being knocked out of it. His coat seemed on the point of being ripped from his body. Where had the grit come from? The forest was carpeted inches deep with dead leaves. The tempest stank of burned sulfur, too, sharp enough to burn Perrin's nose. The horses tossed their heads, mouths open, but the roar of the wind buried their frightened whinnies. Only moments the ferocious wind lasted, and then as suddenly as it came, it was gone, leaving only the breeze blowing the other way. The horses stood shivering, snorting, and tossing their heads and rolling their eyes. Perrin patted Stepper's neck and murmured soothing sounds, yet it had little effect. The banner general made a strange gesture and muttered,
"Avert the shadow. Where under the light did that come from? I've heard tales of strange things happening. Or was it more convincing on your part, my lord?"
"No," Perrin said truthfully. Niald possessed abilities with weather, it had turned out, but not Grady. "What does it matter where it came from?" Tylee looked at him thoughtfully, then nodded.
"What does it matter?" she said, sounding as if she did not necessarily agree with him. "We have stories about Menetherin. There would be brambles underfoot and no boots. Half of Amadicia is buzzing with talk of you and that banner, come to bring Menetherin alive again and save Amadicia from us. Mishima, sound withdrawal."
Without hesitation, the yellow-haired man raised a small, straight horn that was hanging by a red cord around his neck. Blowing four shrill notes, he repeated the sequence twice before letting the horn fall to swing against his chest.
"My part is done," Tylee said.
Perrin put back his head and shouted as loudly and distinctly as he could.
"Danil! Tell! When the last Shan Chan moves below the end of the meadow, gather everyone and join Grady."
The banner general stuck her little finger into her ear and wiggled it about in spite of her gauntlet.
"You have a strong voice," she said dryly.
Only then did she reach out to take the banner staff, laying it carefully across the saddle in front of her. She did not look at it again, but one hand stroked the banner itself, perhaps unconsciously.
"Now, what do you have that can aid my plan, my lord?"
Mishima hooked an ankle behind the tall pommel of his saddle and lowered himself to catch up his helmet. The wind had rolled it across the beaten-down grass halfway back to the line of Shanshan soldiers. From the trees came a brief snatch of lark song, then another, another. The Shanshan were withdrawing. Had they felt the wind, too? No matter. "Not nearly as many men as you already have," Perrin admitted. "Not that are trained soldiers, at least. But I have Ashaman and Aes Sedai and Wise Ones who can channel, and you'll need every one of them." She opened her mouth and he raised a hand. "I'll want your word that you won't try putting collars on them." He glanced pointedly at the Suldam and Damani. The Suldam was keeping her eyes on Tylee, awaiting orders, but at the same time she was idly stroking the other woman's hair the way you might stroke a cat to soothe it. And Nori looked to be almost purring. Light. "Your word that they're safe from you. Them and anyone in the camp wearing a white robe. Most of those aren't Shido anyway, and the only Aiel among them I know about are friends of mine." Tylee shook her head.
"You have strange friends, my lord. In any case, we've found people from Kyrian and Amadicia with bands of Shido, and let them go. Though most of the Kyrianen seem too disoriented to know what to do with themselves.
The only ones in white we keep are the Aiel.
These Gaishine make marvelous Dakovel, unlike the rest. Still, I'll agree to letting your friends go free, and your Aes Sedai and Ashaman. Putting an end to this gathering is very important. Tell me where they are, and I can start incorporating you into my plans."
Perrin rubbed the side of his nose with a finger. It seemed unlikely many of those Gaishine were Shido, but he was not about to tell her that. Let them have their chance at freedom when their year and a day was up.
It'll have to be my plan, I'm afraid. Savannah will be a tough nut to crack, but I've worked out how. For one thing, she has maybe 100,000 Shido with her, and she's gathering in more. Not everyone is Al-Ghaid Siswai, but any adult will pick up a spear if they need to.
Savannah. Ty Lee gave a pleased smile. We've heard that name. I would dearly love to present Savannah of the Jumai Shido to the Captain General.
Her smile faded.
100,000 is many more than I expected, but not more than I can handle. We've fought these Aiel before, in Amadisia, eh, Mishima?
Riding back to join them, Mishima laughed, but it was a harsh sound, no amusement in it.
That we have, Benner General. They're fierce fighters, disciplined and crafty, but they can be handled. You surround one of their bands, their septs, with 3 or 4 Damani, and pound them till they give up. It's a nasty business. They have their families with them, but they surrender the sooner for it.
I understand you have 12 or so Damani, Perrin said. But is that enough to face 300 or 400 wise ones channeling?
The Banner General frowned.
You mentioned that before, wise ones channeling. Every band we've caught had its wise ones, but not one of them could channel.
That's because all the Shido have are with Savannah, Perrin replied. At least 300 and maybe 4. The wise ones with me are sure of it.
Ty Lee and Mishima exchanged a look, and the Banner General sighed. Mishima looked glum.
Well, she said, orders or no orders, that puts an end to finishing this quietly. The Daughter of the 9 Moons will have to be disturbed if I must apologize for it to the Empress, may she live forever. Likely I will.
The Daughter of the 9 Moons? Some high-ranking Shan Chan, apparently. But how was she supposed to be disturbed by any of this?